The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, the final show of the week. That's hard to believe. We're already at Friday, a busy day. Of course, a busy day for all of the packs earlier in the week, and a busy day here at the camp. Last night, we had an open sports activity, so lots of physical activity going on here on campus. And I'm sure as we come into the Sabbath later on this evening that all of our campers are going to be ready to rest and to be rejuvenated. Well, this is a week of quite a few anniversaries. I talked about the July 16th anniversary when I was in Sacramento on Tuesday, the anniversary, the 30th anniversary, hard to believe, of the first reading of Malachi's message, the beginning of the Philadelphia Church of God in many ways. The beginning of the spiritual reign resuming back in 1989. So there's that. We're coming up to the anniversary of the moon landing tomorrow. And then also tomorrow is the, I think it's the 75th anniversary of the assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler. So we'll talk about that later on in this segment. Well, as I mentioned on yesterday's program, when you just look at the cable news and what they focus on, as I was traveling through those cities out west and watching a little news back in the hotel room, just so much craziness, so much obsession with every single word that either Donald Trump speaks or tweets. And so it's been an angry and contentious week, a lot of back and forth, a lot of accusations, all of those hundreds and hundreds of references to racism and racist that you hear now routinely on the cable news networks. And here is how the House chaplain responded yesterday. He's opening the day's activities in the House of Representatives. And listen to this prayer. This is clip 8.
We give you thanks, O God, for giving us another day. This has been a difficult and contentious week in which darker spirits seem to have been at play in the people's house. In your most holy name, I now cast out all spirits of darkness from this chamber, spirits not from you. I cast out the spirit of discouragement, which deadens the hope of those who are of good will. I cast out the spirit of petty divisiveness, which clouds the sense and the desire to be of fruitful productivity in addressing the issues more appropriately before this House. I cast out any sadness brought on by the frustration of dealing with matters detrimental to the honorable work each member has been called to engage in.
That's House Chaplain Pat Conroy casting out the spirits of darkness that have taken over the People's House, the House of Representatives, a sign of the times. Peggy Noonan had a piece on all of these accusations of racism. Now a racist is not someone who actually is racist in his behavior. This is something that, well, it's inherent. If you're white, you must be racist. This is from her column this week. She says, now the idea has taken hold that the charge of racism doesn't derive from thoughts and actions, from what people say and do, but from who they are. If you are white, that accident of birth left you racist, and there's nothing you can do about it. You've got white privilege. You're unconsciously favored, and unconsciously assign disfavor. Either way, you're guilty. No action or word can turn this around. So change is not possible. Improvement will not happen. There's no way out. She says, this is demoralizing. America can never become a better place if it isn't even allowed to think it can. She's talking about how demoralizing this is. You're a racist because of who you are, because of the color of your skin. And meanwhile, you have all of these racist acts that are, well, either just covered up or justified. That's really what's been covered up this week, as they've gone after the president. And you look at these women that he criticized on Sunday and Monday, and consider some of the things that they have said and done and tweeted. Ilhan Omar, she co-sponsored a bill that would stop the government from calling foreign aliens aliens. Apparently, this is dehumanizing. Joaquin Castro, he introduced the bill. And it says, the words alien and illegal alien work to demonize and dehumanize the migrant community. They should have no place in our government's description of human beings. It says immigrants come to our borders in good faith. Did you know this? Immigrants, they all of them, they all come in good faith. Now, if you're white and you're here at home, you can't be trusted. You must be racist. But immigrants, they come to the border of the United States in good faith. They work hard for the opportunity to achieve a better life for themselves and their family. Eliminating this language from government expression puts us one step closer to preserving their dignity and ensuring their safety. You can see why there's such a groundswell of support for Donald Trump in the heartland. These are people that are more concerned about those on the outside of America than they are about those on the inside. And if you dare, as I said on yesterday's show, if you dare speak up and criticize individuals like Omar, who have all, they've had this this track record of racist actions, racist statements, anti-Jew, Jew hatred. But if you speak up and criticize them, well, you see what happens. We've seen it this week. Senator Tom Tillis, he said on, I think it was one of the Fox shows yesterday, he commented on what the media should be focusing on right now, rather than 1,100 references in a couple of days to racism and Donald Trump. They should be focusing on what these four women that President Trump singled out, what they've said, what they've done. Here's what he had to say yesterday, clip 7.
Well, look, anytime you get into a crowd like that, you've got a lot of supporters, they're going to say what they want to say. But I think we have to go back to something. It was on your prior segment that Omar has just proposed yesterday. And that is support for sanctions against Israel. And even worse, as she's describing why people should support it, she said it's analogous to the sanctions against Nazi Germany. I can't think of anything more audacious than that statement about the Jewish community in the United States and our great friends and allies in Israel. We've got to shift the attention back to some of the positions that they're taking that are extreme. Now, the media here in Capitol Hill only want to talk about parsing the president's words. I'm not going to answer a question of them unless they come back and talk about the things that actually lit this candle. And it's the extreme positions taken by AOC, Omar, and the so-called gang.
That's Senator Tom Tillis commenting on these ladies, the squad, as they've been called, the ones that President Trump criticized. We've got to go back, shift the attention back to their extreme positions. It highlights just how extreme the radical left today is. And it's refreshing when you hear a few, there's not that many, but a few voices speaking up to criticize this sort of extreme behavior or these extreme positions. Here's Louisiana Senator John Kennedy, what he had to say about these four, the squad. This is clip one.
This is America. And in America, if you hate our country, you're free to leave. Now, he said that in response to the behavior of the four congresswomen that you're talking about, the so-called squad. I'm not sure the president should exchange playground insults with them. You know, when you try to argue with a fool, that proves they're two. But the president decided to do so. The simple fact of the matter is that the four congresswomen think that America was wicked in its origins. They think that America and its people are even more wicked now, that we are all racist and misogynistic and evil. Now, this is, they're entitled to their opinion. They're Americans, but I'm entitled to my opinion, and I just think they're left-wing cranks, and they're the reason that their direction is on a shampoo bottle. I think we should ignore them.
He went on to compare them to the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Listen to this, clip two.
Well, there's no question that the so-called squad has moved the Democratic Party substantially left. What I was referring to, yes, Tucker, is, I guess, rule number one of political combat. Never interrupt your opponent when he's screwing up. Just let him screw
point.
Up.
Yes.
And they are destroying the Democratic Party. It's just, I'm appalled that so many of our presidential candidates are falling all over themselves to try to agree with the four horsewomen of the apocalypse.
The four horsewomen of the apocalypse. Pretty funny statement there at the end, but he's right on the fact that they're destroying the Democrat Party. And again, this all may be by design. President Trump singling them out because the Democrat Party was really at war with itself. Just last week, the squad, they were out there saying that Biden and Pelosi were racist. And then when President Trump comes forward, the one that they all can agree on, they hate him. They can all agree on that. When the president comes forward and criticizes the squad, then they all band together. And what you've seen this past week are even some of the old timers in the Democrat Party. They've come out in defense of these four newbies. And it shows just how extreme the party is. They're destroying the Democrat Party, as Senator Kennedy pointed out there in that clip. Victor Davis Hanson, he has a piece on the war against history and how that this really is a war against America's future. It's a war over the future of the United States of America. He says here, in their radical progressive view, shared by billionaires from Silicon Valley, recent immigrants, and the new Democratic Party, America was flawed, perhaps fatally, at its origins. Things have not gotten much better in the country's subsequent 243 years, nor will they get any better, at least not until America, as we know it, is dismantled and replaced by a new nation predicated on race, class, and gender identity politics agendas. It's just like my father's brought out in America Under Attack. What they're wanting is to destroy the institutions of the United States. They want to bring down the whole system and start over. This war on history, it's really about America's future. It's a battle for the future of the United States. And so they look at America's history and they say, well, it's flawed. It's fatally flawed. We're not going to be able to fix it. The only way to fix this is to destroy it. Revolution. It's interesting. You contrast this with the way the history is being revised in places like Germany. Here we're dying. Here we're dying by suicide in the United States. And over in Germany, as I said, we're coming up to the 75th anniversary of the Stauffenberg attempt to assassinate Adolf Hitler. July 20th, 1944, Lieutenant Colonel von Stauffenberg, he came to a meeting, a conference room with Adolf Hitler and 20 other Nazi officers. And a few of them had plotted to kill the Führer. He carried a bomb inside of his briefcase and placed it under the conference table during the meeting. And then he excused himself, said he had to make a phone call, left the building. And when the bomb exploded, it killed four people, but Hitler was only lightly wounded. If Hitler would have died, the plan was that the conspirators would take control of the government using the German Reserve Army and then come to some kind of an agreement. It was in 1944, so they were losing the war. And these were individuals that wanted to salvage the gains that the German army had made. But you look at how this history is being interpreted today. The leadership in Germany today is trying to put a positive spin on this. Like, there's just Adolf Hitler and a few of his cronies that are the bad guys, but really everyone else was good. And trying to overthrow him and trying to get him out. This is from Deutsche Welle. Just last week, it says German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Saturday urged strong opposition from all sections of German society against the resurgence of right-wing extremism. It says in her weekly video address, a week before the 75th anniversary of the assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler, she paid tribute to those who opposed the Führer's rule and took action. And this is quoting her. It says they followed their conscience and thereby shaped a part of Germany's history that otherwise would have been solely defined by the darkness of National Socialism. We, too, have a duty today to stand up against all those tendencies that want to destroy democracy. Deutsche Welle says July 20th, that's tomorrow, marks the anniversary of the 1944 bomb plot to murder Hitler and remove the Nazi Party from power. The attempt failed and Hitler survived with minor injuries. The plot's orchestrator, Klaus Schenk, Graf von Stauffenberg, and some 200 co-conspirators were executed. It says Merkel said Germany owes them a debt of gratitude, noting that the country's post-war constitution may not have come into existence without such actions. So we owe a debt of gratitude to von Stauffenberg. Basically, it's Germany today, 75 years on, saying, well, look, we didn't support Hitler. We tried to kill him. We tried to get him out of the way. And, of course, this completely misrepresents and revises the history. This is what Andrew Roberts wrote in his book, The Storm of War. He said, far from acting out of democratic values, the majority of the plotters were simply trying to remove an incompetent corporal who they realized was the major impediment to a negotiated peace, which, objectively speaking, was Germany's only hope of preventing a Soviet occupation. This was their only hope. They were desperate. Hitler, of course, was deranged and possessed. But here were 200 plotters that wanted to get him out of the way so that they could avoid Soviet occupation and still keep the gains that they had made the years before. Regarding the plotters, Andrew Roberts says, there were not many of them, and most were extreme German nationalists, rather than the idealist Democrats depicted by Hollywood. Isn't that interesting? Hollywood. That's the United States. And when we delve into German history, we try to revise it and make it seem like, well, there's some pretty good Nazis. And then you look at what we're doing to ourselves. How demented and upside down is this? The sickness from within. And then we create movies about Stauffenberg. I guess the best known one. Valkyrie, I don't know if that's the proper pronunciation. It's a movie from, I believe, 10 or 12 years ago with Tom Cruise. And sure enough, he's made to look like a hero, Stauffenberg. Well, he was trying to kill Adolf Hitler, so he must be a good guy. Richard Palmer had an article at The Trumpet back in 2008. He said the nice Nazi is now in fashion, a disturbing trend in several newly released movies, the rewriting of Nazi history. Here we're rewriting the Nazi history. It says a specter is haunting Europe. The article, he's quoting from the Times, I believe, the Times of London. Further on, well, he talks about some of these Hollywood movies, like the one I mentioned, starring Tom Cruise as Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg, the leader of a failed plot to assassinate Hitler. In the film, says the Times, he's a man of action and nobility who's surrounded by a cast of equally honest souls. In fact, with the exception of Hitler himself and a few surrounding cronies, it's hard to find a nasty Nazi among them. Well, they're heroes, these German nationalists, these German plotters that wanted to preserve the German Empire. Look, these movies seem to say, being a Nazi wasn't that easy, and furthermore, not everybody caught the bug. The director of this movie, Valkyrie, he's quoted in the article as saying, nobody wants to believe that all of the people are indoctrinated into evil, into murder and such hate. Nobody wants to believe that. So I think Valkyrie will inspire. It'll be inspiring to people. I hope it will. Nobody wants to believe they're all evil. Now, you contrast that with what they say about Americans in the United States, white Americans. They're evil, they're racist, just because they're white. Richard writes, these films embrace a dangerous fiction. The idea that only a few evil men hijacked a nation is simply not true, says Richard Evans, professor of modern history at Cambridge. It's just not true. There is a tendency, perhaps derived from the sources that filmmakers use for these films, to show everyone as being very rational and reasonable. Further on in his article, Richard quotes from historian Paul Johnson, his book Modern Times, where he's talking about Germany in the 1920s. This is long before Adolf Hitler came to power. Paul Johnson says there were proposals for double taxation for Jews, isolation or apartheid, a return to the ghetto system, special laws. This is in the 1920s, keep in mind. Special laws with hanging for Jews who broke them, an absolute prohibition of intermarriage between Aryan Germans and Jews. Calls for the extermination of the Jews became frequent and popular, and anti-Semitic pamphlets circulated in millions. Now, think about Ilhan Omar and all of her tweets against Jews, all of the Jew hatred that comes from that woman's mouth. And that's erased, justified, overlooked. I think I heard Jake Tapper say those are controversial. He said it in the same spiel where he mentioned that the president, however, is racist. Time and time again he says it. Absolutely, he's racist. She says what she says about the Jews, and it's, well, it is controversial. That's all that you can get them to say. Paul Johnson says calls for the extermination of the Jews became frequent and popular. and anti-Semitic pamphlets circulated in millions. There were many violent incidents, but when in 1919, the Bavarian police asked for advice on how to cope with anti-Semitism, Berlin replied, there was no remedy since, quote, it has its roots in the difference of race which divides the Israelitic tribe from our people. You can't do anything about it, the German authorities said. In 1919. In 1919, they said, you just have to accept that there's going to be Jew hatred. There's nothing you can do about it. We're justified. They're different than we are. And when did Hitler come to power? The early 1930s, 1933, I think it was. This is Paul Johnson talking about Germany in 1919, the early 1920s. Richard says here, these recent films portray the rise of Nazism as a one-off unfortunate affair caused by one man in the wrong place at the wrong time. In reality, the rise of Nazism contains a vital lesson for everyone in the world. It shows what human beings are really capable of and how easily mankind can be motivated toward hate. Nobody wants to believe it, as Valkyrie's director said, but that doesn't stop it from being the truth. We don't want to believe there was all that evil, so we'll just make a movie and pretend. We'll pretend that the evil was really isolated and contained in this tiny, tiny, tiny little area. And that really, really, most of the people were righteous. We're good. We're trying to get rid of Hitler, even in Germany. When we come back, we'll look at some more history that's being revised. The 50-year anniversary of the landing on the moon, that anniversary is tomorrow as well. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
Over 8 years and 10 space missions later, 400,000 engineers, technicians, and scientists accomplished that goal.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
A fusion of every scientific realm, a challenge that took man off Earth and put him among the stars. But what of the challenges on this Earth? What about the growing unrest, political strife, and poverty this world now faces? The human mind can send a man to the moon, but cannot find a way to world peace. What is holding mankind back? Is the way to peace even possible? There is a missing component to the mind of man. One missing factor without which peace is impossible. But the way to this missing component can be found. This final factor that will enable man to find peace and prosperity lies out of reach of science and in the pages of the Holy Bible. Visit thetrumpet.com and order or download a free copy of What Science Can't Discover About the Human Mind by Herbert W. Armstrong. With this booklet, you too will understand the truth surrounding the purpose and potential of the human mind.
Trumpet Daily.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's Neil Armstrong 50 years ago. Tomorrow, July 20th, 1969, an unforgettable statement from 50 years ago. An inspiring history, you would think, anyway. But here we are this week. Not surprisingly, you have the New York Times and the Washington Post. They've got a bone to pick with this history. The Times tweeted out one of their articles saying the Apollo program was designed by men for men. It says if we do not acknowledge the gender bias of the early space program, it becomes difficult to move past it. So here we are now with another teachable moment. We've got to look at this history and tell you all the things that are wrong with it. The Washington Post, for its part, says the culture that put men on the moon was intense, fun, family unfriendly, and mostly white and male. It's like they're all getting together. It's like they're all in the conference room together. Hey, how are we going to come out on this one? Here's another reason to go after white males of all things. It gets better. Listen to this. Tuesday's New York Times. How the Soviets won the space race for equality. The Soviets! Unbelievable. The article says the USSR sent women and people of color to space years before the United States. So here we've got to celebrate the Soviet Union responsible for murdering tens of millions of people in the 20th century. But they put a woman and a man of color up in space ahead of the United States. So we've got to tell you this. It says the Cold War was fought as much on an ideological front as a military one, and the Soviet Union often emphasized the sexism and racism of its capitalist opponents, particularly the segregated United States. And the space race was a prime opportunity to signal the USSR's commitment to equality. This is unbelievable. The Soviet Union's commitment to equality. It says after putting the first man in space in 1961, the Soviets went on to send the first woman, the first Asian man, and the first black man into orbit, all years before the Americans would follow suit. So, and these people wonder why there's tens of thousands of people, millions of people voting for Donald Trump. Because they see this, they read this nonsense. Well, we can't even be proud of anything anymore in the United States. It's just like I said in the first segment, the evil, it was there from the beginning and it's worsened. If anything, it's worsened. And the only thing that will solve this is if we just destroy it from top to bottom and start over with the democratic socialist model based on the Soviet Union, really. That's what they want. That's the New York Times. This week, that's the Washington Post. This week, talking about diversity, talking about the white male space program from 1969. What a difference. What a difference when you compare the way that the United States and really the whole world, when you compare the way that it reacted to that event from 50 years ago, the landing of human beings on the moon, 600 million people watched on live television worldwide as Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, saying that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Well, here's another article that can hopefully get the taste of those other two out of your mouth. It says Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had become the first humans ever to land on another galactic body. Michael Collins waited for them, circling the moon in the command module, Columbia. It says the Apollo 11 mission, which bore the hope of a nation and the fascination of the world, had launched 4 days earlier, July 16th, 1969, from the Kennedy Space Center, the NASA facility renamed for the slain president who had set America on the goal of landing man on the moon and returning him safely before the decade was out. Here is that national goal that John F. Kennedy set for the nation in 1961, clip 4.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space. And none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
We've talked a lot at this camp about the importance of setting goals. And when the President of the United States set that goal in 1961, it was impossible. The technology was not there for a man to land on the moon. But is it? You talk about an inspiring story. Never mind what you think about JFK as a president or what you think about him morally. He set a goal, and then hundreds of thousands of people got involved directly, and the whole nation got behind it. And look at what was accomplished in 10 years, less than 10 years. This embodied the American spirit, American ingenuity. We can do it. We can do this. That ought to be inspiring for young people and for all of us. Good things happen when you set good goals. I love this quote, too, by the president where he talked about why they set that goal. This is clip 5.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
We choose to go to the moon because it's hard, because it's difficult, it's a challenge, and we're embracing that. We embrace hardness, the president was saying back in 19, I think that clip was from 1962, after he had set the goal for the nation. It's not going to be easy, but we can do this. That's the pioneering spirit that you used to see in the United States. Continuing from this article, this is from the USA Today. It says, by some estimates, more than 1 million people gathered along the Space Coast shoreline to watch the rumbling Saturn V lift into the heavens that July morning. That's back in 1969, July 16th, it says, what was next? was a journey that would accomplish what years earlier had seemed impossible. The crew had been training intensely. Some 400,000 people, NASA employees, contractors around the nation, had worked long hours, staying late, solving one engineering puzzle after another to make it a reality. It was Aldrin who spoke the two words that have become a poetic descriptor for what they saw on the moon. Magnificent desolation. Magnificent desolation, he said. It all felt like that is what America is, what we can do when we're united in purpose, Aldrin said. Apollo showed that this nation, this America, can do whatever is required when destiny calls on us to unify and step up. It quotes him as saying, it was an honor to be a part of Apollo. That was how I felt in 1969, how I still feel. This is a blessed nation, truly blessed. And we're all lucky to be part of it. I hope we never forget how lucky we are to be Americans. Well, that's a message you don't hear today. How blessed we are to be Americans. How blessed we are to be in this land of America. To be in the land of blessings and prosperity. President Kennedy, in 1961, he also said, but in a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. If we make this judgment affirmatively, it will be an entire nation. For all of us must work to put him there. This was for the entire nation. In fact, as my father has written, he wrote at the 40th anniversary, 10 years ago, he wrote that this was an event that moved the world. The whole world, as I said, 600 million people tuned in to watch this event live. Listen to some of the work that they put in. This is from another article, The Times of London. It says, we moved to working 6 days a week, 10 hours on weekdays, 8 on Saturdays. And if we had to work Sunday, we did. We had a job to do. Apollo 11 was a civilization-changing event. And that thought that, hey, I had to be part of it. It makes you proud. We went 9 years from drawing board to putting men on the moon. 9 years earlier, it was impossible. It was an idea. It was a goal. And 9 years later, you had those two men set foot on the moon. This quotes one of the engineers. A lot of stuff was done with slide rules back then. A lot of people now don't know what a slide rule is. And analog computers. The engineers, you're looking at some of the most fantastic minds in the world, but we still have deniers. A lot of people that still don't believe that we did walk on the moon. You have these conspiracy theorists that say it never happened. It was all faked. I know we did it, and I'd take on anyone who wants to challenge me on whether we really did walk on the moon on July 20th, 1969. I'm 82 now, this engineer says. I'll take them on. He was part of the team. It galvanized the whole nation. It didn't exactly teach us the lessons that we needed to learn from it. I mean, for a moment there, people were lifting up their eyes into the heavens. But what a shame that it didn't go deeper, spiritually speaking. My father writes in the New Throne of David book about one of the astronauts that went to the moon later, Cernan is his name. His space travels served as a source of inspiration and proved the existence of God to him, my father says. And it quotes him, you can let your imagination wander. Put yourself out there 250,000 miles in space on God's front porch, he said. That's what it was like, looking back at the earth. He says it was a spiritual experience. Here's someone who went to the moon after Armstrong and Aldrin, saying that it was a spiritual experience. My father quotes him as saying, "The earth moves with logic and with purpose. I can tell you there's a creator of the universe, because I saw a small part of that creation, and it's just too beautiful to have happened by accident. It just could not have happened by accident. There is desolation out there. Lifeless, barren." Mr. Armstrong talked about this in his writings. "But it is, as Aldrin even said, it's a magnificent desolation. You're looking at God's creation. There's no way it happened by accident." Cernan said, "I wish I could take everybody in the world back to the moon with me and let them look back at the earth. If I could do that, I think the world today would be a much different place. I think it'd be a much different place." It was a spiritual experience for him. And it was a spiritual experience for Buzz Aldrin as well. Fox News had a story this past week, 50 years ago, when American astronaut Buzz Aldrin, a devout Christian, made history landing on the moon. The first thing he did was to give thanks to God. It says here, "I wondered if it might be possible to take communion on the moon," Aldrin recalled a year after the mission, symbolizing the thought that God was revealing himself there too, as man reached out into the universe. "For there are many of us in the NASA program who do trust that what we are doing is part of God's eternal plan for man." This audio here is Buzz Aldrin back in 1969 asking people to give thanks. He's on this mission, landing on the moon. And look at what's on his mind, clip 6.
"Houston, Tranquility, over."
"Tranquility, Houston, go ahead."
"Roger, this is the LEM pilot. I'd like to take this opportunity to ask every person listening in, whoever or wherever they may be, to pause a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours, and to give thanks in his or her own way. Over."
That's actually from a movie about the exchange that Aldrin had with the command center at Houston. But the Fox article actually has the actual audio from 1969. Aldrin saying that, you know, "I'd like to just take a moment to pause and to contemplate the events of the past few hours and to give thanks. To give thanks to God." This Fox News piece says, at the end of the mission, when Aldrin was headed back to Earth, he read aloud a second verse. Well, he went up there, and I think the verse that he read when he was on the moon was from the Gospel of John. But then coming back, he read aloud a second verse from the Old Testament that he scrawled on the same note card. It says, Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4. Our listeners are going to be well familiar with that passage. David's psalm, "When I consider your heavens and the work of your fingers and the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you're mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him?" What is man? He asked a good question, quoting from that psalm. And Mr. Armstrong, when he was writing about this back in 1969, he went on and answered it, taking us to Hebrews 2 and the incredible human potential, the purpose that God is working out here below. It's a shame, really, that all the world didn't look at that incredible feat One giant leap for mankind. Well, in what way? Did we really leap forward from that? Look at where we are today. Look at the way the New York Times and the Washington Post are writing about this history today. We haven't made progress, certainly not morally. And yet you can look back on this history and draw inspiration from it. And you can look back on this history and ask what David asked, and then answer it with other passages in the Bible. And, of course, incredible human potential and mystery of the ages and a lot of other things that we've written. We've got our beautiful universe booklet as well that can help you in your study. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with a few emails that have come in recent days. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Throughout the Bible, God refers to human beings as his own children. Many people, however, say God just doesn't seem real to them. God is a great mystery. Yet, their human fathers don't seem like a mystery. Why does God seem unreal? In Mystery of the Ages, Herbert W. Armstrong answers that question. In this book, Mr. Armstrong strives to make God as real to you as your own human father. Do you realize that God, as described in the Holy Bible, is actually a family? That he calls human beings his children because he wants to be their father? This magnificent truth, once understood, will help you understand your Bible like never before. Mystery of the Ages will guide you in your study of God's Word and will make plain this incredible, seemingly unbelievable truth. We would like to offer you this book, Mystery of the Ages, absolutely free, no cost or obligation. In many ways, Mystery of the Ages is about Herbert Armstrong's close personal relationship with God the Father. It contains a powerful message that God revealed to Mr. Armstrong during their constant contact, their continual conversation that lasted for nearly six decades. If you thoroughly study Mystery of the Ages along with your Bible, you will get to know God. Request your free copy of Mystery of the Ages today. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
A couple of emails here from the last few days. This says, thank you so much for The Trumpet Daily program. I love listening to it as it helps keep me updated and involved in God's work, even from all the way over here in Australia. I really do feel a part of the great headquarters work. I was especially excited to hear from the PAC attendees. It made this work and the PACs even more personal to me. And I'm proud to be part of this work of changing people's lives and giving them hope. What a great God we work for. Another one here in response to my father's trumpet brief from yesterday, or I guess the day before, about why the youth programs or the summer camps. It says, this reminds me of the old days of YOU, Youth Opportunities United. Thanks, and may God continue to do his marvelous work and wonder. This in response to the back-to-back-to-back personal appearance campaigns. I hope and pray that you have a personal appearance campaign in Birmingham, Alabama, or Birmingham, I guess you say, in the United States. I've been living in the UK too long. This one here says, I hope your father's recovering from his right leg issue. I truly appreciate having finally met you. Mr. Culpepper's Bible study was rewarding. This is the follow-up study to the New York campaign. It says, I drove from the Boston area to attend. My youngest son would like to attend a Bible study with me. He took some YES classes in the WCG. I've instructed him to call for the Trumpet and Mystery of the Ages, U.S. and Britain, and so on. I'll give him a copy of Raising the Ruins. This will explain to him what happened and why it happened to God's church, how it was resurrected by God, with the original 12 and $80. That's in response to the campaigns. And that's all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email us some feedback, send it to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.